Station number 14974, Paul Armstrong, rail 3.
Mr. P. Armstrong, Rail 3. As a young man in the 1930s, what were the influences and attitudes that were beginning to have some effect upon you personally?
Well, as I've said previously, I belong to a very patriotic family, and we were extremely conservative. We were readers of the Morning Post, and our ideas were influenced by that. And at that time, people like Winston Churchill were beginning to call about, speak and write about the German menace. This really didn't bother us at the time, because we were committed to the League of Nations, of which there was a very strong branch in Bishop Auckland, and I was into that fully. Went regularly, raised funds, did all sorts, took out leaflets. In fact, I used to draw leaflets for them. And this went on. In fact, we made so much money that I led a party when I was 18, that's right. I led a party, no, I must have been slightly more than 18, sorry, about 20 year old. I led a party of 8 boys and girls from the local branch to Switzerland, to Geneva, to an international conference. And it was there that I think, strangely enough, at it being supposed to be an international peace conference, boys I talked to from various countries like Holland, Belgium, even Switzerland, talked a little bit about their neighbour and appeared a little nervous. I don't think that really impressed me a lot at the time, but we still kept on working until we've come up now to 1938. And by that time, Churchill was really, as far as the Morning Post was concerned, was beginning to worry people. And people were demanding some sort of action. And sure enough, during the latter year or two, was friendly with a number of my friends who joined the Territorial Army over the last 2 or 3 years. And I and one or two more were invited, obviously, to the mess for a drink and a chat. And I used to think, I've had a good life. Why shouldn't I do something for my country? The League of Nations was fine, but I think it failed. So, as soon as Chamberlain came waving his paper, I went to the colonel and asked if I could join. He said, well, we're trying. The government have promised that they're going to double up the Territorial Army. So there will be another battalion formed, which would be the 10th Battalion, and your name will be considered.
Before we go into the army, you said you did many things with the League of Nations in the locality. What kind of things were you doing?
Lecture tours. I used to, making these posters and so on, drawing the posters, getting the schools to, I used to have them cycle styled, and because that was the only medium one had then. We And that step that he used.
Duplicating.
Yes, that he used to have it on a piece of gelatine and turn it off. We used to turn leaflets off then and go around, cycle around, or drive round, or any way of getting round the villages, passing these these leaflets out.
What might the leaflets say?
The leaflets said that we should all live together in peace and harmony. All countries should be the same. And we'd even brought in places like Lithuania. It sounds strange now to think about it, but those three little countries were rejoiced over when they came into the League of Nations. And I suppose one rather tended to hope that it was going to work. But the first crack that I remember personally was when Mussolini went into Abyssinia and they talked about the League of Nations were going to apply sanctions, which didn't happen. And the scales dropped from my eyes. I realised that we were naive. We were just taken for a ride by these continentals. We'd never really believed that they would do it when it came to the crunch. Then you got to the next stage where Hitler started his activities.
What kind of response were you getting locally as you took these leaflets around? Was there an interest in the
League? Yes, yes. We had a very strong branch. Well, to raise the funds to take eight young people to Switzerland raised a lot of money because... it's not a county where people throw money away. They were giving it to what they thought was a good cause, and we obviously thought it was a good cause ourselves. And I remember the people that we met, they all got up and spoke and were very, very fired with enthusiasm for it. And our speakers there, people like Bertrand Russell, were all pacifists. So, of course, they were still hoping desperately against hope that nothing would upset the League of Nations Charter.
Was your membership young? Was it mainly young?
Yes, mainly young, starting from about 14, going up to about 20-odd. But once it got over 20, it seemed as though they fell away because there were too many interests about. Football, cricket, you name it, the interests were there. And the League of Nations had ceased to have the pull it had in the early 30s.
What were the influences, therefore, Mr. Armstrong, that brought you to the decision that the League of Nations wasn't for you?
Well, I would say it was a build-up. As early as 36-37, I was at a summer camp in the League of Nations hall in Geneva with a party from our group in the north, and during the discussions, which were led by the famous Bertrand Russell, a very, very clever gentleman, but I found that he wasn't prepared actually to discuss. He was dictating to us what we should think and what he felt was going to happen. But when we asked him various simple questions, he glossed over and didn't seem as though he was prepared to discuss it. This rather upset me because I felt we had already one dictator in Hitler and a little dictator in Mussolini. We didn't want homegrown dictators. But I soldiered on, and 2 or 3 years passed, and I met a lot of my friends who were in the Territorial Army, And I began to wonder a little. And then one of my friends was in the Newcastle Aero Club and asked me to go and fly with him and see if I would like it. So, nothing loath, I went through with him. One of these, nowadays it seems impossible that we flew in these, it was a Tiger Moth two-seater. And there were no parachutes. We held on tight. I was told during the flight, as we were weaving a little, to keep my feet off the dual controls, which I was naturally pressing through the bottom. And at the end of the flight, I felt that there was little likelihood that I would volunteer for a force, the RAF. I may say, incidentally, I already had one brother in the RAF, a regular, who was a very happy man. But it wasn't for me. Then, as we remember, we got, first of all, Austria was seized by the Germans. Then you got the real thing that did it was Czechoslovakia, a marvellous country who brought themselves up from nothing, and they were just obliterated. Chamberlain went to see them. Everyone knows about the piece of paper. And that was when the scales fell from my eyes. I felt the League of Nations has failed. Nothing had been said. Nothing had been done. We just felt completely let down.
You obviously saw this threat coming.
Oh, it was, to us in those days, the League of Nations, you must think, was to us a last hope. Really, one could see that trouble was coming. We all used to go abroad, strangely enough, in those days. It wasn't very expensive. And in my job as selling houses, I made enough money to have odd weekends, weeks and so on, across to the continent. And the feeling was growing that the Germans were getting too powerful. I must be honest, I didn't think the French were going to be up to what the newspapers said they would. But that was my personal opinion.
Was that through meeting Frenchmen?
We met, yes, meeting Frenchmen who would talk of anything else but opposing the Germans. They didn't want to discuss the future. The Belgians, they didn't want to discuss anything really, and the Dutch were very, very apprehensive. That is the only thing I can say. Young men we met, for instance, I met Germans at the League of Nations school, and at the time I must honestly say that they weren't offensive, bombastic, or anything more than just average young men. But it's your newspapers really are the people that keep you in touch. If you're prepared to read both sides of the papers, you can feel what is really happening. And it was clear to me, as to many of my friends, that there was going to be trouble. And then one day it was announced that the Territorial Army was to be doubled. This was when we got an extension by Chamberlain's visit to Germany. And it was then that I decided I would like at least to do something to pay for the happy life that I'd had up till now. I was actually in a reserved occupation, Rerolls of Heaven on Tyne, making switchgear and other similar sort of things, which change, of course, in war. And the only way that I could get out of being reserved in Rerolls was to join the army or the forces, shall I say. And the only force that I thought I would join was the Durham Light Infantry.
Was this purely because friends were in that regiment?
Yes, and parents, uncles. One had heard of all the battalions. The Durham Light Infantry was the only regiment, as far as we were concerned, in the army. There were the Northumberland Fusiliers. There were the Yorkshire regiments, but we were the Durham Light Infantry. And even before I was a member, I was an honorary member of the mess, and so one became imbued with the spirit.
How did your mother feel about this intention to join?
I discussed it with her, but she always felt that one should lead one's own life, make one's own mind up, and do the thing that one felt one should do. I think that was how it occurred, although she already had one of my younger brothers was already in the Air Force. Another of my brothers had come back from Canada, where he was living with my uncle, and he had joined the Royal Engineers, and he was out in Singapore. But she realized, I felt, that my duty lay in joining the forces to do the little that I possibly could do. So I went and managed to have an interview with the colonel.
Who was this?
It wasn't Colonel Miller at the time, it was Colonel Hutchinson, who was nominated to command the newly formed 10th Battalion, which I hoped to join. He gave me some encouragement, but naturally wanted to know who I was and why I should become a member of the Durham Light Infantry. So I made an appointment to see the colonel of the regiment in Sunderland, Colonel Lang. I went to see, my old schoolmaster volunteered to speak, my old headmaster, Andrew Morrison, volunteered to speak to the colonel for me, and several other people of note in the area willingly suggested that I would make a good member of the battalion.
Was this the usual procedure for an officer joining the regiment, to have these references from local people?
Oh yes, unless you'd served in the officer training corps at school or university, that was the next thing for people like myself had to do, and one was thoroughly vetted very, very naturally, particularly when I'd been an eager and earnest League of Nations man, but they forgave me that, and so my name went forward, and from then on, that was in early October by this time in 1938, from then on I was expected to go down to the drill hall at Bishop Auckland and first of all spend 1 hour each night drilling with the regimental sergeant major, and from memory at that time it was 3 nights a week. Spend another 2 hours with the adjutant, Peter Jeffries, on TUTE, tactical exercise without troops. This actually I found fascinating, even though a little bit tiring, because I had been rising at 6:30 in the morning, going up to Bedburn for an hour shooting, coming home for breakfast, driving from Bishbourne to Heaven on Tyne, working from 9 till 5, driving back to Bishop Auckland, having a meal, and then down to the drill hall at 7 o'clock and staying there till 9. It didn't leave a lot of time for pleasure, but at that time the bit was firmly between our teeth, and with my a number of my friends who joined at the same time, we worked very, very hard.
Were you given a medical when you first joined?
I must be honest. Dr. Val Wardle was our family doctor, my parents' family doctor, and Val said, "I don't think there's anything much wrong with you, Paul." And I said, "Well, no, I don't think there is." And he said, "I would like you to be a member of our battalion." And I said, "Thank you, sir." And that was my medical.
He was the battalion medical officer?
He's the battalion medical officer.
Who was your RSM?
Joe... Oh, God. Oh.
What's the relationship between an RSM and young officers in this training situation?
The RSM, as far as young officers are concerned, is the link between other ranks and the officers, and he is responsible for discipline throughout the battalion. Before we were commissioned, we were supernumerary soldiers, and therefore had neither rank nor anything else. So we were taken over by the RSM and drilled mercilessly. I admired him. He took on a very, very hard proposition when I think of what we were. We weren't used to discipline. We hadn't had much discipline. Life had been a bed of roses. But he made sure that we understood what the rank and file would have to go through, we also would have to go through. He was very good.
Drilling you, what form did the drilling take? In these very early days, as young men...
Very early days, literally, marching, counter-marching, turning, wheeling, saluting. We drilled with the rifle. We did all evolutions of every sort in the drill manual, and we were also used to drill the other potential officer cadets. This wasn't as easy as it appeared. They weren't as helpful as they might have been. You can understand that. But this got over, and the serious business of the night was the toots, which, in retrospect, I am astonished to be able to say that three to four out of every five were withdrawals. Now, whether that was because our adjutant, Peter Jeffries, had foresight beyond a lot of other people's, I don't know. But this is a fact which I thought of many, many times afterwards.
How were you prepared for these toots? You had no knowledge of military procedure.
We were given the Army Manual of Infantry Training, which I am sorry I don't have now. I would love to have kept it, because it had been written, I believe, in the middle 30s. And so it had been fairly well brought up to date, but it, for a newcomer, it was like a primer to a school child. It was holy gospel. And so we studied that as much as we possibly could, so that we could follow these toots. As well as that, certain weekends we used to go out into the country and be shown land and how an infantryman would operate over it. this again was interesting. And I remember one distressing occasion when we were given an instruction to report at Stanley at probably 1000 hours, and regrettably we didn't read the map reference and we went to Stanley, but we went to the wrong Stanley. And eventually, half an hour late, when we'd realised we'd made a bloomer, four of us appeared in front of a congregation of officers standing looking accusingly at us. And to my horror, by the time I'd reached the colonel and stood smartly to attention, I realised that my three friends were very well behind me, and I took the full blast.
Which Stanley did you go to in error?
Stanley Billy Rowe. Well, I've seen this happen before. Eventually, years later, that is in 1940, Colonel VA in the 2nd Battalion had instructed me to meet him with my cell major at a map reference. And having read the map reference carefully, I decided that someone had boomed, because the map reference showed me to be 100 yards out to sea. He appeared and we started following him round on the inspection, and I reported to a brother subaltern, commented to a brother subaltern, that it was a good job I hadn't gone to the map reference shown. The colonel heard this remark, wasn't very pleased, and insisted that I report at the end of the day at his office to read his instruction to the orderly sergeant. I said, yes, sir.
The manual that you talked about previously, was there still a strong First World War influence in the training of infantry?
Oh, yes, yes. This is very interesting because whatever is said, infantrymen are the same as they were, shall I say, for example, in the First World War, in the Boer War. And my personal hobby now that I'm retired is the Napoleonic Wars. I think that Wellington is the most marvellous, the best general we've ever had in this country. And so I read and I have read many, many thousands of words, many, many thousands of pages. And the infantrymen then operate in exactly the same way as our infantrymen did when light infantry were formed. The reason I say that infantry training hasn't changed is because an infantryman really is the man who has to occupy ground. One can have tanks, cavalry, camels, anything, but the actual man on his feet is the one who occupies the ground, and he is the point. Even the Germans have special words for the point. They know and they appreciate only too clearly that it is the infantryman who holds the ground. If one looks back at the last war that our parents took part in, before the time came when it was totally static, it was a question of groups of infantrymen right down to, I was going to say, section level, but from section level, which is roughly 10 men, onwards, the sections moved forward. The platoon, which is three sections, followed. The company, which was three platoons, followed that, and it went out like the fingers of a hand. One can think of it that way. Now, in the Great War, our parents, grandparents, uncles fought in exactly the same way until machine guns put an end to much movement as they could hope for. In the Boer War, it was almost the same. It was infantry and cavalry, but it was the infantrymen that were left to hold the ground. It was the infantrymen that had to fight it out, and that is why the Boers originally were fighting in their own country, mainly being farmers. They were used to use of ground. For an infantryman, ground is all that matters. Going back to Crimea War, even then there was a certain amount of movement, but not as much, because tactics then were still tending to be kept to the line, and so the light infantrymen hadn't really scope. When I'm talking about infantrymen, as a light infantryman, you must remember this is what I really mean.